1939. Played football in 1936, 7, and 8. I finished graduate school in 1954. I graduated from Rice Lake High School in spring of 1935 and decided to go to the University of Wisconsin. I have had thought of this earlier and wanted to play at Wisconsin. I really didn't consider any other colleges. The University of Minnesota is a big school up this way, and we had several stars over there, including Pug Lund and from Rice Lake, and Julie Alphonse from Cumberland, both teams in our conference. However, my selection was Wisconsin. Football and athletics did influence my decision. I was not recruited, and I was a walk-on at the university. I decided to go down there primarily because my friend Herb Paul was recruited and had found a job for me at the Madison Staves Silo Company at $25 a week. Coming from Rice Lake, that was big money in those days, and I took the job. I piled all of the 50-pound cement staves in their stave yard, made by their factory that summer, 1935. I also piled the door frames and other paraphernalia that they make to build silos. It was a toughening job, and I reported for football in very good condition. My career goal, as you ask here in the paper, was coaching. And, of course, I liked athletics, and football was my game. Freshmen were not treated differently in as much as we were part of the squad. However, we were the shock troops and were not allowed to play our first year of eligibility. We would run plays against the varsity. We would also learn the formations and any trick plays that the opponents might have from our scouting reports. We would perform all of these activities against the varsity of the opponent that was scheduled for the next Saturday. I returned to the university in 1951 to get my master's degree, and it was the most convenient school for me, and that is why I went there. The most dramatic changes was the fact that there were many GIs still at the university. The population was somewhat older than it was in 35 through 39, and the college was much larger. We had approximately 13,000 students, if I recall correctly. The university was much larger in the 1950s. Some of the better teachers that we had at the university were Dr. Robert J. Francis, very good teacher, and had a very good background in physical education, interesting and good in fundamentals. There was a Dr. George Mellows that was outstanding in anatomy and teaching of the functions of the body. His lectures were always interesting. He could draw the parts of the body on the board that were perfect and explain the functions of each of the organs of the body. Tom Jones used to come to our department to teach track. Guy Lohman was pretty good in history, and so was Robert North in regards to Phi Ed. Russ Rippey was very good in the gymnastics, and Arthur Mansfield was excellent in the technical end of the sports. Probably the strongest part of the department was in the technical end of the activities we were taught. George Martin was a varsity coach and would help us in wrestling, and he was very good. Some of the new men came in the 1950s. They were quite technical. Some were uninteresting. And we became more of a number in that day than we were in the 30s, when everybody seemed to work together with more interest in both coach or teacher and student. I don't recall many clubs or organizations attached to the Phi Ed department. I believe the women's department of Phi Ed had organizations. However, the men, if they weren't in an organized athletic sport of varsity caliber, they were interested in the undergraduate activities that went on in the Red Gym and the and the recreation activities that were available at that time. There weren't many activities involving the women's physical education department in the 1930s. There were more of these activities, if I recall, in the 1950s. However, I didn't have much time to spend in these activities during the 1950s when I was back for my master's degree. Some of the outstanding classes other than the Phi Ed school were the history, in the history department. I also liked the sociology course that we had there at that time. In history, I believe there was a Professor Reynolds, who was an excellent teacher, made his class very interesting. The Touchdown Club that you request information on was a large home purchased by the university and set aside, as I understand it, so that that land could be developed later on for university building. However, while this house was available, as I get the information, the athletic department rented it from the university and housed many athletes in it. I was on the second floor. There were athletes on the first and a few, I believe, on the third. The Touchdown Club was located on Johnson Street, out near the heating plant. We had one or so graduate students, one of which acted as house supervisor, mostly to collect the rent, as I understand it. I lived there for 1 year. It was a big old building, as I said earlier, to describe the place. It was kept warm and clean. I don't know who did all of this type of activity. We cleaned our own room, and the house supervisor took care of the maintenance of the building. We had double bunk beds and a couple desks to work at. Lynn Hovland was my roommate, who played left guard on the football team and later on became an All-American on some of the selections. I don't know if other campuses had the same type of touchdown club. Incidentally, we dubbed it this name because mostly football players stayed there. I believe it was an experiment at Wisconsin put in by Coach Stuhldreier. It was a pleasant place to stay, and we enjoyed it. Both of us were on the squad. I don't know much of the Doc Spears era. He didn't have much of a winning record, and I think that was probably why he decided to leave. I played under him only as a freshman. As a, you know, freshmen then could not play if it was their first year of eligibility. Stuhldreier was hired in the spring of 36, I believe, and he had a winning record out at Villanova. He came in and took over. We had a very late spring practice. I believe we went into the month of May, and he did a pretty good job of starting to revive the football program at Wisconsin. He was made football coach and athletic director. One of his main assistants was Reagan, Bob Reagan, who was in charge of the line. I worked mostly under him and Stuhldreier. I believe his program was quite well received. It was built on pretty thorough knowledge of the game, and the reputation went from good to great. In 42, the University of Wisconsin was second in the nation, I believe. He turned out many great players, among whom was Crazy Legs Hurst, who is now the present athletic director. There were other many fine ball players under Stuhldreier. He lost something like 12 men to the Marine Corps after his 1942 team. And I think this decimated his recruiting program, and it took him several years to rebuild. If these 12 men had stayed with the university, I'm pretty sure Wisconsin would have been one of the greats in the Big Ten for many years along about that era. Our football team for the 3 years, 36, 7, and 8, had several great players. Howie Weiss, Roy Bellin, Len Hovland. Weiss and Hovland made All-American, and I believe our squad was one of the groups of men that helped turn their program around at Wisconsin. We went from sectional games in our own area, sort of regional, to intersectional games, where we played Pitt, UCLA, and Notre Dame. 10. Chicago had dropped out of the Big Ten about this time, although we did play them in 36. They were a fine club, and had a fellow named Berwanger who was a great runner. We didn't, however, play all of the other Big Ten teams as they do today. Michigan and Ohio State, I guess, were scared of us because we never did play them in those days, in that era. We had large crowds, we had good equipment, and we had a winning team in our senior year. Some of the arch rivals were Minnesota, Northwestern, and Chicago. I played right guard on these teams and was probably one of the lighter men on the, among the linemen. Some of the sports reporters referred to me as a watch charm guard for being one of the light men in the Wisconsin line. Also one of the lightest linemen in the Big Ten. I don't know how much playing football enhanced a man's social standing on the campus as you requested in one of your questions here. To most of us, it didn't help too much. It did, however, expose us to the public and in some ways helped us get jobs around the campus and around the city to tide us over. There wasn't many of us, in fact, I don't know of any, that had outright scholarships for everything as they do today. Most of us had heavy work jobs, muscle building jobs, as I guess they call them in the 1930s. There was more amateurism, I believe, in those days, where most of us played primarily because we liked the game. Also, it did give us a chance to get jobs so that we could survive and get a degree. Even though there weren't many jobs in the 1930s, there was great competition for what jobs that were available, and most of us shot for degrees so that we could qualify for better working conditions than most people had at the time. In those days, as to how the football differed, we had a first team and a few reserves. One of the rules of that time was if you left the game in any one quarter, you couldn't return until that quarter ended. We also had what we called the left halfback, and probably referred today as the tailback, who was expected to run, punt, and pass. He was a triple threat, they called him. We didn't have any special teams at that time, like kickoff teams and place-kicking teams and so forth. There were very few field goals scored at that time. 20 and 30 yards were probably considered quite long. There was no free substitution rule as we have it today, which I am in favor of because more players get a chance to play. The equipment is much better today. There's lightweight plastic, there's foam padding, and the equipment we had was good, but it was heavy. A lot of our jerseys were made out of wool, which on a hot day caused a lot of sweating and discomfort. Our team in the UCLA game lost on an average of 15 pounds per man, and I think when we played Iowa down in their bowl and the weather was hot, we matched this amount of loss, plus maybe a pound or two more. I think the athletes today are larger, faster, and better coordinated. I think they've had better coaching as they were youngsters, say, in the junior high on up through high school. In our day, a six-foot man that weighed 190 to 200 was considered big. Today, he's just an average lineman. There's a couple other things we can refer back to. In the 30s, everybody was expected to play offense and defense. There was very little rest unless you had an excellent substitute sitting on the sideline. Today, there's more rest, which gives the players a chance to exhibit his offensive or defensive skill much more readily. You have to remember, however, in the 30s, the goal line or crossbar of the field of the goalpost was 10 yards behind the goal line. So a 20-yard kick from out in the field actually was a 30-yarder. The place kick was not of the soccer type as we know it today, but it was the straight ahead, kick 'em off the toe type of place kick. Also in the 30s, it was primarily the end of the era of the drop kick for a field goal. Probably Pat O'Day was one of the last great athletes who played at Wisconsin that could kick any distance using the drop kick. However, when Pat played, the ball was almost as round as a basketball, so there was quite a bit of difference in the makeup of the football. The football in the 30s was reduced in size so that the passer could more readily handle it. Also, the quarterback under the center became a standard part of the backfield towards the end of the 30s. And this then changed the whole complexion of the game. Prior to that, the single wing, the double wing were the main offenses, along with the Notre Dame box, which we used at Wisconsin. So you had quite a few changes coming up during the 30s, and much of this was accelerated in the 40s and on up until present day football. I think we're going to see even more passing with many plays called the dipsy doodle type, where there may be one, two, or three passes, or reverses with passes, or reverses with a cross field pass, and a return pass, and a downfield pass. So I don't think there's any loss of initiative on present day coaches, and some of this is showing up now as I watch high school teams, college teams, and the pros are using some of the dipsy doodle too, because the straight ahead cloud of dust 5-yard type of offense is very boring. At least it is to me, and I think the pros are starting to recognize it. On the defense, the standard 7-man diamond defense, a 7-man line and diamond defense in the backfield, was used quite a bit. Also, the 6-man line and the 3-2 back arrangement was used quite a bit, so that you'd have 6 men on the line, 3 men, 3 linebackers, and 2 safety men. This was varied quite a bit and different. However, towards the end of the 30s, the 5-man line was coming in. The 6-man line, 7-man line seemed to be going out on defense. Also, the advent of the pass meant that there was realignment of the men in the backfield also, so that in the 40s and 50s, defense became quite a science, and it still is growing. Today, you'll notice the pros have 3 men up front with a variety of linebackers and safeties and different arrangements, sometimes called an umbrella type of defense and so forth. So that I think the offensive defensive formations will still be changed quite readily, and we'll see many new types of offense and many new defenses put up against them. As the rules change, so does the offense and so does the defense. So most of your rule makers try to keep some kind of a balance so that offense or defense doesn't get too far in advance or have too much advantage. Some of the names used for the plays we had on offense: we had a quick kick. We had a kick formation with a screen pass off of it. We had the single reverse, the double reverse. We had the Statue of Liberty and delayed pass on the offense. The kickoff formations were quite standard. Place kicking formations were quite standard. Almost every college used the same type. Sometimes when you got an exceptional good backfield man, some of the coaches would change their plays or at least emphasize certain plays. For instance, if the fullback was the star or the halfback was the star, or if you had a good throwing tailback with one or two good receivers. So plays were put in to augment the abilities of the men who are playing at that particular time. We seem to have quite a variety plays it all the time. And then I believe Stuhldreier and the quarterback would sit down prior to the game and take from our repertoire of plays those that they thought would work best against, say, Northwestern, Chicago, Purdue, Indiana, Minnesota, and so forth, depending on their type of defense, their type of lineman, how big the team was we were playing, how fast they were, and things of that nature. During the football season, there wasn't too much leisure time. For a couple of years, I had a schedule that went something like this. Down to work at 6:30 in a restaurant. Stay there till 7:30 or near 8, head for class, work from 12 to 1 in the restaurant again, have football from 3 to 6, and then work from 6 to 7 or so at the restaurant. So the day was quite full. My junior and senior years, this schedule was a little better, so that I had some time. Places we used to go to were the Ember Inn, the Top Hat, the College Inn, and the Chanticleer. Of course, some of these places were out of town, and that meant finding somebody that had a car. Cars weren't as plentiful in those days as they are today. The Old Ox Road and the Picnic Point were places that we went to. The Memorial Union used to have plays, theater, or movies, I should say, and uptown at the Majestic, they used to have the name bands of that era come in and play several times a year. They had some fall dance, they had the prom, of course, and there was other dances during the year. The attitudes regarding alcohol was sort of a minimum, and as I recall, the main drink of the day was beer. There was smoking, of course, both the cigar and the cigarette, lots of pipes among the students. Sex in the day was about the same as it is now. I guess we used to call it petting. Drugs seemed to be at a minimum. I don't recall of any in our group, and to my knowledge, there was a minimum amount in use at that time. Usually by the time you got a job, worked at this, sometimes quite heavy work. For instance, I worked at the Farbach Brewery, which was located down near the present Elks Club. I was paid 50 cents an hour to load trucks and to stack the beer on the warehouse floor. So a few hours at that after going to school or working on Saturdays when we weren't playing football, call for as much rest time as you could get. The education was financed quite a bit like it is today. I think half of our student body worked. There were some NYA jobs, some other federal jobs, and work seemed to be part of the most students' daily activity. As to how you get your job, sometimes after being at the college, you could locate different types of work by your own initiative. I got a job in a restaurant through a friend of mine in Rice Lake. Worked there for 2 years, and I had work with the university, cleaning up in the North and South Hall, and other work when they needed some young guy for services. I also worked at the brewery, as I mentioned, and this was something I did for 3 or 4 years down there. The Farbach family was very good at help for students. I had a friend also playing baseball that worked there. And if there was need for extra men at special times of the year, then either Pat or I would find somebody on the campus and probably get a job for part-time down at the brewery. In the restaurant job, you were expected to work 3 hours a day, and your meals would run about 30 cents a meal. So you actually made 30 cents per hour for the hours you worked. At that time, you could also sell a pint of Bud at $25 per pint. The fees at the university were $27, so I'd have to scrounge around and find $2 to pay my bills. Usually do this every fall and at the semester, so that a pint of blood got me pretty well established as far as the fees went. I don't know if it was a common way that I did see other students selling blood at the university hospital when I was there. I don't know how this practice started. I was tipped off to it by another student. As a student, graduate student, I did attend on the GI Bill. There was so much allocated for per veteran, plus so much for the wife and children. And I forget just what the fees were that I received, but it sure helped a lot to get through graduate school. We also had book fees, lab equipment fees, and pay, some kind of pay increment for the family. So having this money available after World War II was certainly a big help for the young men going back to college to get advanced degrees or to finish their college work.
Well, this one isn't.
As far as religion and how it played a part in my college life, it was the same as life before college. I'm about a Sunday go to church type of guy, and that's about what it was. I did stop in once in a while at the campus rectory and student house. That was about the extent of it. As to student attitudes of the day, I guess everybody was pretty much set on developing his own lifestyle. There was a lot of work, at least in my group, so that thinking of yourself and how you could progress in this whole world of ours, and probably being of help to other people, you didn't have much time for other groups as such. We had a few blacks, some ethnic minorities, there were Indians from India. The students from India were dressed in their native costumes so that they were quite identifiable. We had other groups from out of state, primarily from the eastern states. As I was informed, these students, I was told, could come to Wisconsin, live in our dormitories and fraternities, and get by cheaper than they could out there in the Ivy League schools. This is about all I have to discuss on the student activities. I don't recall any big controversies as we had here in recent years at the university. There was some hazing, there was some rough and tumble activities down on the lower campus. Of course, the big library was not there in those days, so there was more area for students to roam around. I believe in the early time, prior to the 30s, they used to have some kind of a freshman brawl down there on the lower campus, mud fight or something, but I didn't experience any of this. The Daily Cardinal was on sale down there. It carried the activities of the campus plus the football scores and so forth. So we'd read it probably for our own interest. Those of who were interested in the sports read it for that. Those who were interested for their social activities used it for that and so forth. It was a good paper. It stirred up a little controversy now and then. I thought it did a good job and served its purpose well. I knew Dean of Men, Scott Goodnight. However, only as acquaintance, I had not met him for any other purposes. He was doing a good job there, as far as I'm concerned. I didn't have any encounters with him, as you ask here. And I thought he was well received by the student body, or at least by the men. I don't remember much of President Glenn Frank. However, there was a President Dykstra that came over and talked to us on the football field during a practice. He did a pretty good job for the short time he was there, and this is about the only encounter I had with the presidents of the university. We The question on State Street and Madison, I think Madison was probably 100,000 or so at the time. State Street stretched from the square down to Park Street, and it was lined with merchants. I believe the Orpheum and the Majestic Theaters were up on the second or third block from the square. We had a place called the Amber Inn that was frequented quite a bit. Of course, there was the College Club down by the where the library is now. And then you had a White Castle in there by Brown's Bookstore. And I don't believe there was a brat house on State Street as such. There was a little eating place, block and a half, two blocks up from Brown's Bookstore, that had food. Of course, there was Toby and Moon's right there on the alleyway up from Brown's Bookstore towards the Capitol. There was quite a few students who would eat in there with Toby and Moon. Both had been football players. Toby was Tobias, was his last name, I guess, and Moon was Moon Molinaro. They were characters on the street, very well received by the students, and as I understand it and the experience of it, did a good job helping the students. State Street was pretty much all business at that time. I recall going to the White Castle for 5 cent coffee and a 5 cent donut. Many times this was my morning breakfast. I worked at Frank's Restaurant over in University near Park Street. And this was a eating place for some of the students, especially at noon and for breakfast. In the evenings, I don't know, the students seemed to disperse all over the city. There's, if I recall, a place named Kelly's out by the university in Monroe. I don't recall of any one place where the football players would gather after a ball game if we played at home. Most of us had our own living quarters and small groups, so we would split up and be with our own group. I thought there was pretty good relationship between the students and State Street merchants. At least I didn't see any controversies as there appeared to be in the 50s or after World War II. To my knowledge, there existed a pretty good relationship between the Madison police force and the students. There wasn't many controversies in those days, so that the police wasn't necessary. This is side two of a two-part tape. This material is for Professor Barry Tyker, project co-director of this history project. I hope this material will be of some use to you. However, I believe it should repeat my material, and I would appreciate some of the uses or some information on the uses you make of it. This is John P. Blackie O'Brien speaking now for side two of the two-part tape. I believe I ended with the police and the relationship of the police with the local people. I think there was a pretty good relationship between the students and the police, much better than there was in the 50s when there was seemed to be quite a bit of confrontation. Beyond State Street and what restaurants and shops and parks and so forth that were popular with the students, I can mention the fact that many students would frequent the Cuba Club, Justo's, the Top Hat, the Amber Inn, the College Club, the Chanticleer, depending on your date or what activities were going on at that time. There was another place called Hammacher's, which was south of the square, and I forget the address. You could get a nickel sandwich down there, usually cheese or something of that nature. They also served beer by the picnic and by the pitcher. And they had sawdust on the floor. It was a well-run place. It was quite popular and clean. And students used to frequent it, probably because of the lower prices. But it also sort of a hangout. Another place was the Nicholas Steakhouse up on the square, just south of the Park Hotel. This place had very good aged steaks. It was frequented, if you had the money, by students in college, or the parents would sometimes take their students down there for a good treat, and also by people coming in for sporting events. So this was quite a popular place. The other big hotel up on the square was the Lorraine, or near the square, and people used this facility quite frequently. Smith's Clothing up on the square was used some by the students. However, I believe it was McNeil and Moore down on State Street where many of the students shopped. However, we shopped all over the city, wherever the best buy was, I guess we were there. Another place was the Burr Oaks Golf Club out on South Park. I think there's some big shopping centers there now, but we would play golf there once in a while, primarily because we could get out there on the bus and get back by the bus. Wallace Park was within walking distance, and we'd go there once in a while to frequent the place in the spring or fall for a good walk or hike or any kind of sporting activity we had in mind in some of those large fields there. Walking the bus, somebody's car if it was available, were three modes of transportation. I didn't see as many bikes on the campus in the 30s as I did in the 50s. I don't know what the reason for this was, but probably bikes were just too expensive for students at that time. We did have another mode of transportation, the 10-cent cab, I guess you could call it. The first zone was 10 cents, and then a graduated scale for zones beyond the first. We would use this mode at times for dates and other times when we needed a fast transportation across the city. it was quite a popular mode of transportation, and they seemed to, the cabs seemed to be quite handy at the time if you were on State or on the square. Clothing store up on the square that some of the men would frequent. The modes of transportation that you ask about was done by walking, by use of the bus, car, if you could find somebody that had one. But I did not see the use of bikes in the 1930s that I noticed in the 1950s. There was an awful lot of bikes then in the 50s, but not as many in the 30s as this mode of transportation sort of took over. There was another type of transportation, the zone type taxi cab. I recall the first zone was 10 cents, and then there was a charge for each zone beyond that. And dates and other times when you need transportation, this 10-cent cab, as we call it, was quite frequently used. As far as students getting along with the local youth or Madison youth, I thought the relationship was pretty good. At least I don't recall much of a controversy then. There was always, as in all college or university towns, some difference between the local people and the college students. However, we stayed pretty much down on the campus, if I recall, and there wasn't much of a controversy between the local inhabitants and the student body. Your question on career goals and so forth that you ask here, I wanted to be a coach. I completed the course at the University of Physical Education. And I got out and became a coach and coached for 40 years after graduating. This includes some time in the service and back in the coaching ranks after my years of service. I thought we had good quality students then, and the courses offered at the time at the university, at least the ones I'm acquainted with, were of good quality. And I think the education we received at the university was as good as any place in the country. I was back at the university during the 1950s to get my master's degree. I also went to a summer school in 1969, and I had a daughter that graduated from the university in 1970, so I'm somewhat familiar with the education and courses and the type of education offered at the university from the 30s to the 70s. In your question here and other comments, I guess I've talked about long enough. I enjoyed working on this project. Hope it'll be of some help. All I can say is I met many people down at the campus. I have some good friends from that time to present. I had a lot of fun in the college years down there, although this state may sound serious at times. I had my share of fun also while at the university. I like Madison as a city and try to get back each year for football games at least once to keep in touch with the campus. This is a tape is up for your use in the history project. At the present time, I don't have anyone to recommend that might want to be on this tape, except some of the men I mentioned in the taping. I think this tape probably should remain somewhat property of myself. I would like to know how you plan to use it and probably some idea of how it is used. However, it's yours to be used on this project. And with that, I'm signing off. This is John P. Blackie O'Brien. I have a postscript here. You may notice that there's some duplication on the earlier part of this part two. However, the material is essentially the same, so you'll be able to see what happened or hear what happened. Another man I'd like to mention was George Mills, a local druggist who had gone to the University of Wisconsin. I believe he was in the class of 1919. He played baseball down there and was a local alumnus and was a very great supporter of the University of Wisconsin. He talked to me a lot about the university. He also received the Wisconsin Alumni Spark Plug Award later in his life, and he helped me get my first job at Frank's Restaurant, primarily because I guess he worked there when he was a student. He did help me get down to the university, so going there was part of his idea, I guess. Another fellow was Frank McCormick of the Wisconsin State Journal. I got to know him somewhat. We had what they call at that time the empty stocking boxing fund, and I think he was a promoter of that. One of the deals at the time was to have a lineman and a backfield man box in this empty stocking fund. I was pitted against a guy named Jimmy Martin, who played in the backfield. The winner was to get a treat up at Nicholas Steakhouse, and I was declared the winner. The idea was that you could eat all you wanted, and I proceeded to do that. I started with a double porterhouse, then ate a single porterhouse, had a hamburger, piece of pie, cup of coffee, all the trimmings that went with the steak, including the potatoes and so forth, and went home. Frank used to talk about this and write about it on several occasions, but it was probably just an ordinary good meal for myself.